Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin on the brink of back to school.
Woo!
Joined today by Mr. Back to School himself, yes. Texas Politics Project Research Director Joshua Blank.
Hello.
Josh, are you ready? You seem ready.
I mean,
you seem ready.
I'm willing.
Well, you know, you've been teaching this summer, so it's really
true.
Know,
there's been not much
of a transition.
No,
in
and
some
the,
ways.
The kids were home all summer. I'm very ready. Actually, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
It's good to be ready. Like, Will's ready.
Yeah,
in the booth.
Everybody,
double thumbs up from Will. We're good to go. So, you know, maybe a little scheduling semi apology. So my calendar was messed up. I thought we had a podcast last week. We showed up. Nobody was here. Totally our fault. Yeah. This is news to Will, but
yeah.
No, it was totally our fault. I went back and looked at the email of our reservations, and we were not supposed to be here last week, even though I had told anybody listening that we would be. So apologies if your expectations were just crushed. but we're back today, and you know, a lot going on in the world. I mean, another big data center hearing yesterday, this time in the Texas House and State Affairs. I didn't watch it all, but what I did watch and via reports, you know, a little less inflamed than the last couple.
Yeah.
Subject for another podcast probably about where we are in the policy process and the political process on this whole issue and what we make of it. It's still very much out there. I mean, it's very much hitting the national press.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, my God.
The newsletters have been all about this and talking about this. And I do feel like we were a little ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah, and it's worth, and in some ways, I mean, the attention we keep getting to it from people sort of justifies, like, let's talk about it a little bit more here. You know, let's flesh this out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it is an issue. I mean, I've been asked three times in various, you know, whatever, for the public record.
Right.
So is the data center issue going to be an issue in the election?
Yeah.
And, you know, my answer is kind of yes with an asterisk, I think. I mean, it's definitely out there and shaping things. And we don't want to go too far into this. But I do think it's one of those things, you know, per a conversation we were having earlier off mic about AI, it's one of those things where it's now out there and it's a contest to see how you use it and how it gets framed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
Because it's clearly salient. We'll have, you know, some polling data next week showing
where that stands, right?
The increase in salience of the attention to the issue.
Yeah, that's right.
It's another little teaser. And I didn't even tell you. I popped a little teaser about the poll on the Tribcast I recorded earlier this week. I didn't give up any information, but I did.
That's your right. Just thanks for letting me know.
For better or for worse.
Thanks for letting me know.
The discretion
I was going to say, the question that I get that's sort of a different angle on that one has been a lot of, like, you know, so to sort of evaluate, I'm putting that in quotes because that's not my job, but sort of to some extent, you know, these evaluations of Abbott's approach to the issue and what that does both now and then going into November is another sort of question that's out there.
Right.
A little more locally.
Well, you know, and particularly because he's obviously doing a lot already.
Yeah,
right. So
yeah, it's noticeable.
So what we had on tap for today, and to be honest, we had this on tap last week.
Yeah,
that's just, you know, to be honest with our listeners.
Yeah,
we wanted to, and still want to, look under the hood of this ongoing discussion of rural discontent in Texas and what the impact may be in the November election. And I would add, and we'll focus on this probably less today, but and this is driven in part by the discussion of data centers and the implications for the upcoming legislative session.
Right, yeah.
Which is, you know, where we dine out heavily. So look, on one hand, the anecdotal evidence of rural discontent is pretty clear.
Right, yeah.
You know, having had another hearing yesterday, if you watch that, you don't need to hear from me on that. You know, and it's particularly in the public pushback against data centers, the building of high capacity power lines. And I would also say in a way that is a little different than those.
Yeah.
The attention in the last few weeks to federal construction related to border security mm-hmm. in Big Bend.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just right. real quick. I mean, you know, it's notable just to say real quick, among the issues that you listed are two among very, very, very few. In fact, it would be hard to find any others in which Texas Republican statewide officials have positioned themselves at a distance from the federal government and from right. the Trump administration.
Right. And vice versa.
Yeah, there's been this. Yeah,
there's an interesting sequencing thing.
Yeah, there's a sequencing
right?
thing.
As people know.
Then Trump came back and the federal government came back and said, okay, yeah, we're pausing it. But that's also right. interesting just to say, like, there is something going on here because we haven't seen many instances where, again, I think it was interesting, you know, with another round of sort of Abbott's, I guess, pronouncements, executive orders, whatever, on data centers, that Trump was sort of cool to.
No, he was. No, that's what I was going to raise, is that in terms of the call and response there, the response from President Trump was directly negative.
Right.
And again, got a lot of coverage.
But that's the thing. I mean, that's why it's sort of like, you know, even if you were sort of like wondering, you know, does this issue matter? You know, is this going to have legs? I mean, in and of itself, this is already presented itself as a really interesting issue because it's actually created.
It's pretty leggy.
It's actually created a division among Republicans in a, you know, honestly, where we haven't seen any.
Yeah.
For a while. And so that's sort of right. in and of itself, there's something going on here.
And that includes public opinion.
Right.
Right. That's, you know, I mean, I think we've talked a bit recently about elite opinion, you know, in some other areas, elite opinion, what's going on in the base.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go into another semester of teaching intro government,
mm-hmm.
and I've mentioned it to some folks, there is an element of responsiveness here that we ought to be a little bit, I think people should be not so quick to go, look at Greg Abbott, he's backtracking.
Oh my God.
And I think we talked about this. And it could be we've already touched on
this. I don't know, but if not, I'll just say, you know, like, look, I mean, some people have said this.
Theoretically, this is what he should
be
doing.
Yeah, this is called responsiveness. This is called, you know, I mean, like, yeah, that's what a politician should presumably do when a new issue emerges and facts are being uncovered and a sentiment is being formed, like, is to, you know, I mean, first of all, you know, go in those waters, you know, you can play, you can, you know, try to, you know, you can try to adjust people's expectations, but ultimately, you should probably be responsive to what
the channel, one of our colleagues,
thinks.
The thermostat should kick on.
Yeah, that's
theoretically, right?
Right. Yeah, it's getting a little
hot. Okay, so that does not, all of which is to say, the thermostat in this case doesn't respond to all stimuli equally.
Right.
And that brings us to this question of what's going on in the rural areas and what should we think of as the political consequences of the fact that there has been, you know, substantial pushback from the rural areas on what had heretofore been the agenda of, all things being equal, the people that the vast majority of rural voters are sending to Austin.
Yeah, that's right.
If not to D.C., but in this case, we'll focus on Austin.
Right.
So, you know, our June poll added some data to the anecdotal evidence that we keep hearing.
Yeah.
Right? So fewer than one in four rural Texans supported the construction of a data center in their community, while 62% were opposed, and half of the rural subsample were strongly opposed.
Right.
Right. Now, this is hardly news by now. Pretty well established that there are some pockets of intense opposition to these data centers in rural Texas. But I think these numbers do show us that it's pretty widespread, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, you brought it up, and I'll just mention right now. I mean, Republicans themselves as a group across rural, urban, suburban, you know, areas were split on, you know, sort of the construction of data centers,
right?
Which is why this is, I mean, it's just at a very basic level, why this is a hard issue for Republicans, right?
Right.
I mean, it definitionally is splitting their voters right now. But to your point, it's not splitting voters in rural areas. In rural areas, we're seeing significant opposition. We're seeing more opposition than suburban and in urban areas. And to put it on the other side of it, we see very little support.
Okay, so let's unpack the underlying logic of that position, right? Let's start with party ID. Because it's not as if the rural areas are not still predominantly Republican. I mean, I think if you were to read a few commentators, usually with a position, you get the sense that Republicans are now alienating rural voters. But
You
know, the party ID in the rural areas is not showing some big sign of an earthquake, right?
No, I mean, look, throughout the polling, and I'm going to we have a, I mean, we've got like 50 or 60 polls of data we could like look at and how we can compare it. So I'm just going to paint with some broad brushes here because we don't need to go crazy. But I mean, what we generally tend to see is in the rural areas among registered voters, you know, Democratic identification doesn't really break 30%, really doesn't break the 20s. And in most cases, it's probably below 25%, which really matches about the high that they get in actual election returns.
Yeah.
On the flip side, you know, we look at Republican identification, it's pretty rare to see that identification drop much below two-thirds. I think around two-thirds is what you would think of. And again, but that's among all registered voters. And then when we actually get to like the elections, we tend to see closer to 75% of that vote in rural counties, or counties we can designate as rural, going to the Republican candidate, right? And so, you know, the party ID numbers aren't showing some sort of falling out the bottom, right?
A little bit of attrition though, right?
A little bit. Well, I would say, I mean, I think a little bit. I mean, you
but
know.
Not, I mean, not enough to hang our hat on.
No, I think we should just bring up, you know, right now as a piece of this, which is, you know, what we're talking about here is we're talking about margins among groups within the coalition, right? And rural Texas is a small share of the overall state population, and you can define it in different ways, and we can just talk about that, but we're not going to.
Well, I was going to, you know, put a pin in that because I do want. I was going to say before we move on to the attitudinal stuff,
yeah,
talk a little bit about that. I mean, you're allowed to nerd. You know, we're allowed to nerd out a little bit on this podcast. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, it's tricky.
You know, we've done work on this.
Yeah, and please jump in if you know because this is a lot of things. So first and foremost, just from a measurement standpoint, let's just start at the basic. You know, when you say rural Texas, it's kind of like, what do you mean? Well, ultimately, it's in the eye of the beholder. And so for the U.S. Census Bureau, for the federal government, and for state government in a lot of cases, what they actually do is they define what's urban, which is usually based on population density, maybe suburban, which is based on lower population density, some contiguity, those things being close together. And then everything else is rural. So in some ways, rural is just what's left over from the non-urban, non-suburban.
Now, no offense intended.
No offense intended. Now, additionally, there are other ways to think about it. Actually, I think a really kind of intelligent way to think about it that gets to some of, I think more gets us into kind of we're getting the political sense, which is some people look at commute times to economic centers is another way to think about this. And that really, I think if you live in Texas, and I think if you live really anywhere with any kind of commuting culture, like that probably feels a little bit more real because how, where you live in some ways can be defined by how far away you are from whatever the city is that you live in and around, which is where most people live. And so that's the thing. There are people who can live in areas that were, you know, and also these areas have changed, right? So there are areas that were rural that have become ex-urban, that have become suburban in some cases over the last 20, 30 years. A lot of places that were rural are now ex-urban, like kind of just on the outskirts of the suburbs. And this ultimately changes these places in terms of whether people are moving there to be in a rural place away from the city or whether people are moving there for its proximity to the urban center.
Or both.
Or both. And so it's just becoming more complicated. And then on top of that, there's two other pieces, which is historically, just for the sake of looking at data over time, it's just a lot easier to use counties because the lines don't change. And so a lot of times we'll just designate counties as urban, suburban, and rural. And then those rural counties are basically, again, those counties that are largely just not urban or suburban. But that's most of the counties in Texas.
Right.
Now, of course, the last piece of this is that political districts ignore all of this and they just overlap in various ways across these different areas.
Or they take it into account, but not in a... Not in a categorical definitional way that's helpful.
Well, honestly, well, what they do is that, you know, because, I mean, look, everybody who's listening to this knows the way that the state draws its district lines and it's a political process. And knowing that 75% of the vote in most rural counties has historically gone to the Republican candidate, what we see is maps that are drawn in a way that maximizes that fact in order to support a map that, you know, advantages Republicans. So, you know,
that can happen a couple of different ways.
And it can happen.
Though,
well, so, that's the thing. Know. Well, and that's what's interesting. I'm actually gonna bring this back, I think, where we want to go. And so what's interesting, if you've been following Texas demography and population growth and redistricting.
For all of you following Texas.
For all of
demography.
You following those things, you know, I've got
Lloyd,
some,
we hope you're listening.
Yeah, there's like two there's a couple there's three people I'm thinking of. But, you know, if you think about Austin, it's a really interesting example, right? Especially the congressional district. So before the last redistricting, I think there were six different congressional representatives whose districts touch parts of Austin. Now, Austin is overwhelmingly Democratic, right? But those districts then go and span out into these very rural areas that generally would then make up for the difference that they would lose in basically in Travis County in Austin, right? Well, at the last round of redistricting, you know, what basically became apparent was because of population growth, because Austin has drawn so many people. Essentially, they did something that people had kind of asked for. You know, and again, people had asked for this.
For different reasons.
For different reasons. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of different reasons for this. But they made an Austin-specific district, right?
Right.
That basically was one, which is basically the Lloyd Doggett and Greg Kassar district, right? But what that means is that those Republican districts that had sort of, I'd say, like almost a finger into Austin, now they much more rely on the suburbs, which have also grown a lot.
Right.
The suburbs, and then these rural areas. So this is all to say, though, that while rural Texas may not make up a majority or even a plurality of the population in the state.
Not even close.
Right. More like one-fifth or less. The Republican vote margins in those areas are not only, you know, important, they're probably necessary for Republican competitiveness at the top of the ticket when the election is close.
Like this one.
So if you have, you know, we always talk about 2018, and one of the sort of the stories of 2018 to a lot of people was the fact that, you know, Ted Cruz was in trouble. He ultimately was able to win the race by about 2.5 points. But the story that people tell was just that, you know, largely that Greg Abbott and others had to go and really mobilize in rural Texas to run up the numbers.
The story was some basis in fact.
To run up the numbers there in order to overcome the challenges that he was facing in some of the urban and suburban areas. And so to bring that up, that all back today, you know, if you're wondering, you know, okay, it's a small share of the electorate. It's overwhelmingly Republican. It remains pretty darn Republican. Why is this such a big deal? And the answer is number one, Democrats are running candidates in every state house race, in every state house district, every state senate district, and every congressional district. So there are candidates in all these areas. And the question becomes, and I don't know, I don't even run the numbers here, because there's a lot of different ways one could run these numbers, anyone could make it up. But if the idea is that Republicans generally win elections with 75% of the rural vote, the question becomes, in a tough election year, when, you know, suburban areas are going to be much more competitive, already looking much more competitive, could Republicans still win statewide if they've got 70% of the rural vote, 65%, 60%. You know, and so I think this is one of the things that, from my perspective, is just sort of watching the way the coalitional thing is going, is like right now, all this attention makes a lot of sense, because so long as Republicans are underperforming in these areas, it's almost like the base. You got to start there and build it back.
Well, and what I was, you know, I was kind of thinking about a more limited point, although that stakes here.
Yeah.
But is that also in these numbers, there's something hiding that I think is important in both the voting discussion you're talking about, but also the policy discussions that have been swirling around this, particularly the data center thing. And you mentioned the term exurban in there, and that is, it's not, and this is about how we're asking the question, but I've not seen that anybody else has come up with a better, more finely tuned way. You could ask about the size of the town you live in, or we could try to sort it by zip code or something. But that is that I think, I don't know how many of those exurban areas are, when we ask people where you live, how many of the exurban people are saying rural and how many of them are saying suburban? And I just, you know, I don't think there's any way. I mean, look, there's a zip code way to know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I think there are people that are living out in those very edge exurban areas that I suspect are among those that are very unhappy about the data center location. That when we ask them, maybe saying rural, even though it might be fair to think of them as suburban. Anyway,
well,
I don't,
but you know, but you know what that gets into? And that gets into something important, though, which is, you know, it speaks to just like the massive growth that's gone on in Texas here, which is, you know, these areas have changed really dramatically in the last few decades. And while data centers may be the current sort of, you know, policy issue that's animating resistance to change out there, it's not the first.
No.
And I think, you know, you brought it up maybe in the last podcast. It was a good thing to find, which is, you know, when we ask Texans about the about population growth and whether it's good or bad for the state, and especially for the area that you live in, you know, the rural response is pretty negative about population growth. And we've done some polling just specifically in rural Texas in the past. And, you know, we've done open-ended about what it is about rural Texas, like what it is about where you live. And I mean, honestly, we have a trouble like verbalizing this.
It's the sense of place. It's the sense of what we settled on.
And that's what we settled on. It's a sense of place where, you know, people who have chosen to live in these communities they don't expect there to be a lot of change. They don't expect the natural environment to have, you know, a dramatic shift because of business interests. And so this is really running into some just, you know, I think in some ways it's like it's the same story. It's still about population growth and you know, economic growth and all that kind of stuff. But it's also, you know,
a different chapter in the same saga, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then I think the thing that's also, you know, I don't know if you want to go here, but it's sort of overlapping all this is that, you know, the national environment is negative. I mean, there's just, you know, and yeah. you know, we also say sometimes we kind of joke like, hey, by the way, Texas is part of the U.S.
Yeah.
So, you know, but also rural Texas is also part of Texas.
Well, I think we're going to have interesting data that speaks to that, that we can incorporate into the poll rollout next week.
Right.
So,
right.
Okay. So let's look a little more. Let's go back and focus a little bit more on rural attitudes.
Yeah.
So in terms of the immediate political threat in the context that you kind of laid out there.
Yeah.
So views of the national economy have grown increasingly negative over the course of the Trump presidency. We know, you know, it's a...
It's for everybody. It's, I mean.
For everybody. And we should note that the negative attitudes towards the national economy in rural parts of the state were sky high going into the 24 election.
Right.
So this is, we're not saying this is something that's new, and it's a function of the economic environment at the time and the partisan configuration, Democrat in the White House. But then they did drop fairly precipitously after Trump took office.
Mm-hmm.
But by February 25, it was beginning to go back up again, right?
Yeah, right. So, you know, when Trump entered office, rural voters essentially were split. You know, they went from being extremely negative during the Biden years to split. And then, but honestly, between April of 2025 and the end of that year, views had flipped and more rural voters were rating the national economy poorly compared to positively. And so that's sort of the issue, though, is that is in some sense, like, this has been going on for a while.
Right.
This isn't like this just happened. It's not just Iran and it's not just gas prices, which I should say, that's like a big deal. I mean, if you sort
sure.
of, I mean, we've done various projects about this, too, and like decarbonization and other things. But like, you know, if you live in a rural part of the state, your commute is
you
longer.
Drive a lot.
You drive a lot. And so the gas
prices.
You don't
take the bus and you don't take the train. You don't jump on a scooter. You don't call an Uber.
No, you use gas.
Right.
And so that's like hitting really hard. But the thing was, is these numbers were negative, you know, even before, but they've really supercharged and over the course of the last year where we've just, you know, have seen along with everybody else, real negative attitudes towards the national economy. And that's just hard.
And the attitudes are also negative in terms of their personal economic situation, right?
Exactly. And it's pretty much a little bit of the same thing. There was sort of a period once Trump was elected where it was ready to, you know, turn the page, benefit of the doubt, you know, new administration. But again, this is really... really been pretty negative. I mean, even going back to the pandemic, you know, no more than 30% of rural voters have said that they're doing better economically compared to last year in any of the 29 surveys conducted since August of 2021. And that's another important point. We've kind of gone away from this. I think we've sort of, you know, I was saying for a long time, like, you know, we're still kind of in the tail end of the pandemic for like, you know, even though there were years where, because you could see in the data.
Yeah. It's a different thing now.
It's a different thing now, but it's also notable that the economic challenges of these rural communities have like not really rebounded. They haven't seen the rebound that other parts of the economy and really other areas have seen since the pandemic. And we can see that in the numbers. And that's sort of troubling, too.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, data center development in its earlier phases for the backlash was sold as a response to that very frequently to the local stakeholders.
Right.
And now these economic attitudes, and we're kind of beating a dead horse, but it's also reflected in the most important problem numbers, too, particularly. I mean, not even particularly. If you look at the most important problem responses in Texas over time, you know, rural areas like the rest of the state have moved steadily towards economic concerns becoming much more competitive with immigration and border security in those responses during the first 2 years of the Trump second term.
Right. And I think with everybody else, what you're also seeing this is, and this may, I mean, we could break this down a little bit, although the margins of error, sampling error get pretty big, but we're also seeing, you know, the creeping up of corruption and political leadership is a most important problem in the rural areas too, which has generally been something that's been driven by Democratic views. But again, this is not unimportant in the sense that we're talking about margins here.
Right.
We're talking about whether, you know, a Democratic candidate can push from 25 to 30. And it's not that that changes the outcome of that race. But these things aggregate.
Yeah, it could aggregate the statewide level. Now, speaking of that, let's look at rural views of Greg Abbott and the state's political leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the most prominent immediate political slash policy fallout of rural discontent with data centers and the power lines has been Greg Abbott's very direct and I would argue, very, you know, relatively decisive response. You know, ordering a temporary halt on approving new data center connections, pending state audits, lots more rhetoric around that, calling for legislative prohibitions against placing disruptive AI data facilities mm-hmm. inside rural residential communities, more financial and resource guardrails on the tech operators, getting them to pay their own freight, to summarize briefly. But it all does lead to the question. I mean, I think we have assumed, and I think rightly, per our earlier discussion of the thermostat or responsiveness, mm-hmm. that the governor was responding to something real. And the question is, you know, do we see it in the governor's job approval? It's separate whether he saw it.
Right. You know, I'm reluctant to say so. I mean, we're kind of like looking where he's at right now. Right. And in the June poll, you know, he was among his net job approval was plus 10, which is the same as where he was in April and June of 2022, which was the last time, you know, he was on the ballot.
Right.
Won that election pretty comfortably in the end. And so I don't think that, you know, I mean, what's interesting to me is you know, we're looking at a lot of numbers in various ways. And one of the things that stands out is Greg Abbott. Right. I mean, relative to almost all of the other Republican possibilities, for the most part, he has a little bit more shielding, it seems. And part of that is just the nature of the political system. He has more control. Sure. He can use the bully pulpit. He can do everything that you just said. He can. So, right. I mean, it's very easy for him.
He can do stuff.
And
he's increased his capacity along with the expectations in the way that he's occupied the governorship for the last decade plus.
That's right. So I think the decline is slight, right? I mean, there's a little bit of decline in his rural support, but it's hard to say that that's, I mean, I don't think that's a data center thing. I think that's an overall environment thing of which it's too hard to determine. But I think the important thing here, and I think what people are going to ask is, yeah, but what about the trial ballots, right? Like, is this like impacting him here? And I'd say like very little, you know, so we can do some comparisons. You know, if we look at June 2022, so back when he was running against Greg Abbott, among rural voters, 60% said they were supporting Abbott, 23% said O'Rourke. And again, this was registered voters in June of the election year. So obviously, as the campaign went on, these numbers were going to move. But we're just seeing for a similar comparison. In June of 26, Abbott's at 55%. Hinojosa's at 31%. So he's down 5 from where he was. She's up 8 from where O'Rourke was. So, but I'd also say, you know, this is kind of around where Abbott's been. I mean, if Abbott gets up to 62, you know, 60, 62% of the poll, that's kind of where he's been in the polls that we have going back around this time, going back to 2018, 2014. So really, he's kind of sitting about where you'd expect him to sit despite all of this.
And that's a good position to be in if you are going to try to appear responsive.
Right, yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
And I mean, it'll be interesting to see in the next poll what happens with that.
Yeah, for sure. But it's manageable, you know?
Yeah, and it's on the low end of the range, but I think you make a good point that, and how we, I think that's one of the things I want to try to tease out while we're here, which is, to what extent is this environmental? To what extent do we want to attribute it to something specific? Mm-hmm. Because if it's in the general environment, mm-hmm. which I think is a very plausible hypothesis.
Right.
That, you know, people might want to go, aha, the rural people are deserting him because of data centers and power lines. But no, it may just be that their numbers are lower because their numbers are kind of lower across the board right now.
Yeah.
Given the environment. And I'm just reiterating your point a little bit, but I think the point I want to tease out there is that mean that the governor has some levers to pull, and he's pulling them. And I suspect that it's going to help.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, the way I think about it, I like that. I like the way that you put that, which is, you know, the data center thing has presented itself, I mean, in some ways, I'm pretty sure there's as an opportunity to deal with the fact that currently, right now, the Republican brand is a little damaged given the national numbers, given the economic numbers, everything else. And so here's this thing that's like, yeah, it's a problem, but it's also something you can address.
And again, we should also, and by comparison, it's fair to also point out the Democratic brand isn't in great shape either.
Yeah.
And they, in Texas, they have fewer levers to pull.
That's exactly right. I think that's
going to be an important piece, I think, as we go into the fall campaign.
I think that's something
post-Labor Day
campaign. We're going to pin that for maybe a piece in a further podcast, because I think that's becoming increasingly apparent. And it's something that's, you know, interesting here, which is that as much as the national environment is putting wind in the sails of Democrats and is, you know, creating challenges for Republicans, you know, there's a reason that Texas has remained a Republican state. And it's clear, you know, in the numbers that, well, Democrats have avenues of competitiveness. It's also, to your point, I think there are a lot more levers that the Republicans can pull to improve their numbers among groups that would traditionally support them. And that, again, there's a reason they traditionally support them. There's a reason rural voters traditionally support Republicans, and it's not because they're so clear on data centers.
That's exactly right. I think I would agree with that. So that said, let's look at the other another big factor here, and that's the use of Donald Trump.
Right.
Because Trump looms over this election. In some ways, everybody's analysis of what's going on in the electoral environment, whether at the state level or national, does include these implicit assumption that we've all internalized, and I think that because Trump is in power, that there's a Republican president, and then add to that the fact that this Republican president has some very specific kind of characteristics that are making this dynamic even harder, that is going to be good for the out party.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So Donald Trump still viewed very favorably among rural folks.
Yeah. I mean, when we look at just, you know, favorability ratings here, just net, he's plus 12 among, you know, registered voters who describe where they live as rural, right? Compared to in, you know, the urban environment, he's minus 13. Suburbs, he's minus 15. And then obviously, you know, this, you know, like always, the question is, well, is this, what, how does this look like, you know, over time? Plus 12, is that strong? And the answer is, you know, it's not great. You know, I mean, yeah. overall, what we're really seeing is, you know, we're seeing him in the kind of high single, low double digits where, you know, if we go back even to like February 2017, he was plus 25. He's regularly been between plus 30 and plus 40 during much of his first term in office. And even honestly, during the beginning of his second term in office in February 2025, he was plus 40, plus 35, plus 32, plus 35, plus 32 throughout all of 2025. And it's really tailed off now in a kind of a noticeable way. Now, again, I think one thing that's important here is we're talking about all rural voters. And I think, again, we don't have enough sample size at a certain point, is that Democratic rural voters tuning in who, you know, normally are not being spoken to by candidates, who are now getting more engaged? Is that include some Republican rural voters maybe tuning out and just not wanting to kind of like, you know, engage? You know, we kind of have to wait and see. But that's also, again, why this is coalition management. This is why there's so much attention to this group right now, especially from Republicans, because ultimately, you know, this has kind of been the time to do it. You don't want to be doing this in the fall.
Right. And an environment. Because of all the factors we've been talking about, smaller increments matter in this cycle.
Yeah.
Is that the way I think to summarize part of
it? Yeah.
Well, and policy-wise, you know, he's still, like in the rest of the state, he's still in net positive territory in the rural areas on his best issues, crime and public safety, border security, immigration. He's easily in net positive territory. But he's net negative in rural areas on the issues that are front and center for many voters this cycle, including Republicans, to the tune that you can mention a minute ago in terms of the rise of inflation and the economy as factors, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's minus 15 on inflation and prices, which voters are consistently telling us is the most important issue facing the country and the state. He's minus 4 on the economy, which we, you know, which is kind of good relative, you know,
to where he is nationally.
And actually he's plus 12 on trade, which is, you know, interesting overall in the way that kind of that whole thing is filtering through to these communities that actually have a real, you know, potential impact with trade.
Right. I thought that was pretty interesting too. Now, the ratings we got in our last poll on his traits, and by traits, to remind people, we give people a set of broadly positive characteristics, psychological or personality characteristics, and ask people how well they fit the president.
Yeah, and I think in this one, the one that is going to just stand out, you know, for Trump in particular, because of his brand, and I think just where people are interested is, you know, we ask whether respondents feel that he cares about people like you. It's notable that among rural respondents, it's higher than among suburban and urban respondents, but it's still almost evenly split. It's net positive, but 48 say, you know, yes, he cares about people like me. 44 say, no, he doesn't. Which,
on one hand, pretty good for a city guy, even if he's from an outer borough.
Right. But on the other hand, it's not, you know, it's not great. You know, it's just not great, especially when you combine that with the fact that people's concerns are economic, right?
Now, to be fair, you know, he is in clear net positive territory.
Right.
On all of the traits, except that the trait that he struggles with most in most of the polling, and that is honest and trustworthiness.
Yeah, and there it's still evenly split, 45-45, right? So, you know, I think the point here in some ways is, you know, I mean, I don't know. We probably got some different points, but I mean, I'm mostly interested in the coalition. I mean, to me, what drives my interest in this is the fact that knowing what the elections have looked like, knowing how important rural Texas is to the GOP coalition and knowing the Democrats are at least putting up efforts out there, it is really interesting to look at these numbers. just because it is one of those things that shows the way that, you know, small changes can have big impacts in elections.
Right. And here, again, as we've said a couple times, particularly close elections.
Yeah. And that's the thing. We're not going to see something sort of jumping off the page here in any sense. And we can see in general sort of slightly negative numbers, but the bottom's not falling out either. But it's also sort of clear why Republicans are doing so much work right now to either address or seem to be addressing the concerns of various rural constituencies. Because, you know, yeah, their numbers are good, but they need to be a little bit better.
Right.
But, right. You know, so that's sort of my kind of takeaway from this.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think in some ways it's a, you know, I don't want to invite people to go. It's a little bit of an elaboration of the obvious.
Yeah.
Right. To the extent that the bottom is not falling out on Republicans in the rural areas.
Right.
Right. It's not like we've got a bunch of rural people going, hey, I hate these data centers. I hate these power lines. You're building a wall. Yes. Where's Bernie Sanders when I need him?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's not going on. Or even where's Gina Hinojosa when I need her?
Right.
But there is something incremental going on. And I do think that it does help explain the decisiveness of the response.
Yeah.
And again, by decisiveness, you know, I would imagine there are people out there that are very critical of the data centers or the power lines or the wall or, you know, any number of policies mm-hmm. that Republicans are implementing here that we're seeing some friction on in the rural areas. I'm not saying that Greg Abbott has solved the problem.
No. Right.
Right. But he has addressed it in a way that, to your point, is very mindful of the broader coalitional pressures. Mm-hmm. That he has to cope with.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's unrealistic for anybody to think, you know what he's going to do? He's going to tell Meta and Amazon and the big tech companies to go, you know what, themselves because the rural folks are pissed off. That's not going to happen.
No, that's not how this works.
But that's why, that's one of the things that makes politics interesting, frankly.
Yeah.
Is that there's a balancing act that has to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg Abbott can be responsive without giving the other side what they want, because the fact of the matter is, if people are accusing Greg Abbott of doing a U-turn and abandoning his principles just on what he's just given what he's done so far, then, you know, imagine what the criticism would be if he did come out and say, you know what, I've just decided we don't need any data centers in Texas, and I'm going to grab a torch with some guys and wheel on down, and I'm going to join the protests.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
Get the Rangers.
It's just, you know, it makes zero sense.
Yeah.
You know, from a analytical point of view. But I think, you know, one of the takeaways that for us to wind up is I want to tap into something that you had mentioned offline and that I think is lurking here and that I was also trying to get at a little bit with what I was thinking about with the definitional
thing. I'm thinking about the same thing.
Is that I think what we'll look at, and we'll probably look at this as part of what we see in the next poll, is where the people are, and that is the suburbs.
Yeah.
Right? And there is an aspect of these issues, more the data center than the power lines, but there's an interesting aspect of this, I think, on the border wall, which is activating or aggravating an area that is more, you know, numerically more important to Republicans, and that's the suburbs.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things, and, you know, we're going to keep looking at the data and keep getting into this, but, you know, I think that even though we're contributing to it, there can be an overemphasis here on the suburbs, given the fact that what we're also seeing is we're seeing, you know, very competitive suburbs right now, and the expectation that the urban areas are going to lean Democratic, especially in this cycle. Well, I mean, just real quick, you don't need we do back of the envelope calculations, but, you know, if the Democrats win the urban areas, and let's say they pull even or win most of the suburban areas by a couple points, you know, there might not be enough rural voters left to make up those margins. And I'm not sitting here saying like, oh, that's going to happen. But I'm saying there's a lot of stuff going on here. And you know, to your point, I think Republicans have more levers to help themselves with here than Democrats do, both internally, institutionally within the state, but also having to do with the overall brands and everything else. Obviously, Trump may help or hurt, you know, some of those efforts along the way. But it is also the case that, you know, you can't help but look at this right now. And in some ways, and I include Republican efforts to shore up what should be their base.
Right.
As another indication of how competitive this election cycle is going to be. Because normally Republicans, I mean, and Abbott just did this, you know, would be carpet bombing their opponents just about now as people head back to school,
yeah. Well,
which is beginning. Yeah, Abbott just spent $7 million. Abbott just spent $7 million. Gina spent $900. And then I was like, that's cute. And then threw down almost $10 million, right?
To be a little fair, that, you know, they got a lot of bang for the buck on that $900,000.
They did.
Because the AI motif of the internet ad she did got her some earned media.
Well, you
got
to be more clever when you're not rich, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, so there's that going on. But I also
That's been my experience.
But part of what I want to just highlight here as we kind of end this is that, you know, as much as we're focusing on the rural parts of the state and the attention to it, it's almost like this is like very much the first round and we're going to see a lot of pivoting like right now because there's a lot more competition in a lot of other parts of the state. And this is really just about getting the margins up, not about like, you know, really the bare knuckle kind of fight that we're going to see in a lot of these other parts.
And
of
look,
the state.
Republicans have been in Texas, have been very frank about this.
Yeah.
I mean, they, at the strategic campaign level, people, Republican operatives know this. And this was what we saw in 2024. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen some indications of this. I mean, whether it's a feint or it's a real thing or where it falls in between, you know, this is where Governor Abbott's pronouncements that he's going to double down on Harris County is part of this, right? And if you look at the increased margins that Trump experienced in 2024, it was by increasing Republican shares in areas that are not thought of as Republican strongholds. They did better in some urban areas. They did better in the Valley, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have to revisit all that among Latinos. And certainly, I think part of what we're seeing is that much as the Republicans wanted 2024 to be a baseline, it's not. It's a data point, but it's not a baseline.
Right.
And so we're seeing these efforts. This is not new, but they're doing it. But this is happening now with Republicans under duress.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And it's going to be very interesting to see how it unfolds. And from a polling perspective, people are now paying more attention. They're about to pay more attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to accept the old saw, but Labor Day's right around the corner.
Yep.
People, as you like rightly point out, people are beginning to spend more money. You know, I'm thinking of Game of Dragons, where the dragon's under the snow toward that last deeply flawed episode, and the dragon kind of shakes off all the snow, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, there was a dragon there.
Yeah.
That's what Republicans would like to be doing, whether they can or not, I think, is another we shall see. So, yeah. Josh, thanks for being here. Thanks at all to our excellent, and today I'm noticing very attentive. Maybe it's just because we're closer to the window in this booth. But thanks for your guys' excellent work. Thanks to all of you for listening. You can find all this data and much more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Keep an eye out next week. We got some new stuff coming. And we'll also be back next week, probably a day early, with another Second Reading podcast. So long and hydrate. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.